Well, good morning, everybody. Just to say, we're going to give people a minute or two to join just to establish this. It's 11 o'clock, but if we'll give it about another minute or minute and a half, and then we'll get going. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our To Know Insights call. At the beginning of the year, three letters dominated the business world, ESG, standing for Environment, Social and Governance. They were ubiquitous, and for a consultancy like To Know, it looked like we would be speaking of little else. Then along came coronavirus, and since then, the business world has been dominated by little issues like which sectors will survive, and will our economy and the way we work be changed forever? But look closely, and during the last few months, there's been a nagging reminder of how important this subject is. From reports that the Antarctic is registering record temperatures, through to mass protests at the killing of George Floyd, leading to serious questions about diversity and purpose in business. I have to admit, I'm looking forward to this session more than others because I really want to learn something. I often feel I leave conversations about ESG not really sure it's tightly defined enough, and it all can be a bit of a catch-all. What does it really mean, and what does the good look like for a willing business in this space? I get the E and the S, but what about governance? Are these letters really a natural fit? Is it too much to ask of businesses, many of whom are just trying to keep their heads above water post-COVID? Fortunately, we have a great panel who can answer what I'm sure are some of my simplistic questions and some more sophisticated ones from you. Claire O'Neill was Minister for Energy and Clean Growth at the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. She's now Managing Director at the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. James Harding is the co-founder of Tortoise Media. He's a former editor of The Times and director of BBC News. He has some fascinating research on business and ESG. David Blood is Senior Partner of Generation Investment Management. He can help us properly understand what ESG actually is and how business can act. And Martha Carter is Head of Governance Advisory at To Know. You can help us understand how ESG is developing across the Atlantic. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on the call, apart from James Harding, please hang up now. This isn't intended for outside broadcast or publication. So that done, let's get to it. David Blood, I'd like to start with you. Can we start by defining what we think ESG really is, particularly after COVID and things like Black Lives Matter?
Yes, good morning, Craig. Good morning, everyone. One of the challenges that Craig mentioned in his opening is that the questions around sustainability or ESG become muddled because these are terms that many folks have different perspectives on. I thought maybe just to give you a sense of how we think about it might get us all, at least for the moment, on the same page. The first is to realize that sustainability and ESG, environmental social governance factors, are actually two separate ideas. So we can almost think about sustainability as a macro series of questions. I'll come back to that in a second. And ESG as micro, company-specific types of questions. Our framework that we developed 17 years ago, I retired from Goldman Sachs. My last job at Goldman Sachs was I was head of asset management at the firm. Believe it or not, you can probably tell from my gray hair, I've sort of been at finance for 40 years. And when we established Generation, we were trying to address the business case for sustainability in ESG. And our framework that we've been working on over these last 17 years is based upon three points that will hopefully try to bring together what we mean by ESG and sustainability. The first, and it's very important to say this, and it's particularly within the backdrop of the question that Craig raised, is that sustainability and ESG are ultimately long-term issues. And in fact, it starts with a recognition that long-term business planning, long-term investing is best practice. So long-term sustainability and ESG are indeed linked in terms of how one should think about this. Sustainability, and one can think of it as sort of drivers of change, macro factors like climate change, like the environment, like health, like sustainable development, like inequality, like poverty challenges, water challenges. These are broad macro issues that are increasingly interlinked and driving economies. In fact, our view has been from the very beginning that sustainability drives economies today and will increasingly drive economies. And therefore, in terms of understanding the context of business, understanding what is likely to be economic opportunities, is critical to have sustainability as a holistic set, backdrop of how you're thinking about industries and companies. So the first point is long-term investing is best practice. That's how we start the framework. Secondly, that sustainability is a driver of economies. Again, sustainability broadly defined. And that the third premise here, or third platform, is that environmental, social, and governance factors are tools to help either business leaders or investors understand the quality of the business and the quality of management. They're not necessarily a checkbox exercise. I'll come back to that. They are tools. They're frameworks to understand businesses and management teams. Critical point to note is that ESG factors are driven or are directly related to the success of business. They're directly related to the success of business. So this entire framework is business driven. This entire framework is about trying to understand the position of an industry or the position of a company in the changing world that we're facing. So what have we learned over these last 17 years as a way to sort of kick off this discussion is, first, sustainability and ESG, whether you're a CEO or an investor trying to manage the challenges of sustainability and ESG, is hard. People like to think that it's win-win. Actually, the second point is there are, in fact, trade-offs. It's not win-win in every instance. Thirdly, it is certainly not a checkbox exercise. Businesses and industries have their own cadence, their own way, own challenges, and you can't think of an industrial business in the same way that you think of a consumer business or a financial services business. And lastly, many folks think that sustainability and ESG is about risk management. It is, but it's not just about risk management. It's actually about understanding the opportunities of facing businesses and, of course, the opportunities as investors. I think maybe I'll stop there, Craig, as sort of the overall framework, and turn it over to you and my colleagues on the panel.
Thank you. That was really helpful. I'm going to turn to you next, Claire. You've been in government. You were running COP for a while. Now you're at the World Business Council and trying to encourage businesses to engage on the environmental side of things. Tell us about what conclusions you've reached with all that experience.
Well, the conclusions I've reached are that it's incredibly difficult at an intergovernmental level to drive real action. You know, if you think that the Rio Earth Summit, where all this started, was in 1992, and that kicked off the process of the annual assembly of governments and a whole series of soft commitments, really, for governments to make on the international stage and hopefully to translate back home into real policy. And since that point, global emissions have risen by almost 50%. And having sat through the ins and outs of some of the negotiations in the last COP in Madrid, Now, this is a very difficult process. It's the most extraordinary lift to get governments to attend, to assemble, to agree joint visions, if you like, which is essentially what the Paris Agreement is. But turning that into real action that actually delivers results is unbelievably tough. Governments really set a strategic direction, in my view. They can obviously be heavily involved through their own co-investment with the private sector. They can legislate, and I, in fact, brought in the net zero legislation for the UK, which was first major industrial economy to legislate for a net zero economy in 2050. But the devil is in the detail. We know it's very easy for politicians to make promises, and the average shelf life of a prime minister is 4 years. And increasingly, what I saw with the COP hat and indeed the ministerial hats on, was this head of steam building in the private sector, basically saying, yes, we understand government's set direction, and clearly with the tool of overseas development finance, you can have a big impact in terms of bringing projects to market, driving energy transitions in poorer countries. But we're fed up waiting as companies and sectors for really specific signals or indeed really specific policies. You know, how long have we been talking about the idea of carbon pricing needing to be a much stronger signal? And it's taken us 20 years to get the ETS system in Europe to start to issue pricing signals that are really registering on a graph. So what I found, and indeed I found this at WBCSD, is this impatience, if you like, for corporates, often spurred, and this is why it's so interesting to hear David's perspective, by now the demands of investors, both debt and equity, to say, we understand that there are big climate risks that you're not pricing in, but we also understand there are huge opportunities in this big transition. Let's get on with it. And I think particularly the impact of COVID has distracted so many governments from really thinking hard about what they're going to do in a climate leadership space. You know, we do have a coalition of the willing. The EU is doing extraordinary work at the moment, particularly in bringing China to a more ambitious position. And of course, they're using the stick of potentially having border tax adjustments based on carbon intensity, which is a really powerful policy tool. But, you know, the business world is starting to ferment and say, we will put forward targets and we will back them up with investment and governance and transparency. And we really want to move forward on this. And in fact, you're almost seeing an arms race now of ambition. So you've had companies saying, we'll be net zero by 2050. And here's how. You've had big, major global fossil fuel companies like BP marking down the entire or their entire oil portfolio, a thing that we thought was years away, now saying that we've actually reached oil globally. You've now got the tech companies in an arms race saying, well, we're going to be net zero by 2030, or as Amazon, I think it was Amazon said, we're going to offset everything we've ever emitted historically. So you've now really got a sense of ambition. It's not universal. It needs to apply, obviously, to supply chains. And increasingly, the conversation is, how do we apply it to consumers? And there are big missing pieces of the puzzle. But to loop back really to what David was saying, when we talk about ESG and the Business Council is the Council for Sustainable Development, I feel the E bit is starting to be articulated much better. You now can talk about net zero. You can talk about your climate emissions. It's much, much harder to say what good looks like in the S&G spaces. And yet, as we've seen, particularly in the US, that is really starting to resonate with the corporate world. So like you, Craig, I feel confident about some aspects of the progress. I think we have a huge amount more work to do definitionally to get this sort of micro analysis that David started to talk about, that we need essentially to make good decisions in the private sector.
That's great, Claire. Thank you very much. Fascinating. Questions are starting to come through. So just to remind you, if you want to type them in there, we'll put them in the second half of the call. James, I'm going to come to you now. At Tortoise, you've been doing really interesting work with this Responsibility 100 Index and the Responsible Business Forum. Tell us about what your findings are. You're on mute, James.
And you warned us that would be a problem before we started. It's really interesting listening to David and Claire and realizing that what we're doing really is intended to be the journalistic echo of a lot of what they've said. So just to back up, in case people don't know, we set up Tortoise, as Craig said at the start. I was working at the BBC. We had this huge machine on news, delivering an extraordinary volume of news at extraordinary speed. And yet, you know, to pick up on David's point about the long term, it felt hard to see what was driving the news. So we set up Tortoise as a slow newsroom, not to add to breaking news, but to try and understand what was driving it. And our focus was really around five things, around our planet, technology, wealth, identity, and the 100-year life, okay, that we're living longer and the impact that has on a whole range of public policy. And when we started thinking about how do we do a different kind of business journalism too, it was about the impact that business is having and the businesses that are performing best. And we came up with this idea of the Responsibility 100 Index. In part, to be honest with you, it was prompted by a conversation with Richard Curtis, you know, the film writer, Love Actually, etc., but also the driving force behind Comic Relief and one of the really, you know, pivotal figures in the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Because we were talking about how do you make investment decisions on companies, which are the good ones and which are not, and how do you break the world of ESG out of financial services, out of Wall Street and the city, and make it intelligible to all of us. And we set up the Responsibility 100 Index with a really simple idea, which is we would map the FTSE 100 companies against their performance on the UN Sustainable Development Goals, all 17 goals. And when you start doing that, although that seems like an impossible task, when you start breaking it down, actually it makes sense. So the first decision we made, and forgive me, Craig, I'm going to go a bit through methodology because I think it has an impact on some of the companies that are joining us today. The first thing you have to decide is whether or not you're comfortable with public data. And our first choice was to say, look, we would only use public data because we could only therefore, you know, compare apples and apples. And we also thought there was a public good in that, in that it would encourage companies to produce more data. The second choice was, how do you organize all of those 17 goals? And we essentially split that between people and the planet. And so if you look at the goals, you can see that there are a fair amount around, you know, education, skills, poverty, inequality. And then obviously there's a good deal around biodiversity, the sea, and most significantly, sustainability and climate. So we broke it down to people and the planet. And then the next thing was to try and measure the difference between what companies say they do and what they actually do. And so we had these two measures, because what they say is important. What they say is, you know, is an indication of where they're going. So we had a talk measure and a walk measure. And the walk measure is what they're actually doing. Now we scale that 1 to 4, and we scale each of the separate elements, the two big buckets, people and planet, and 7 pillars overall. And then we mark each company against 5 particular measurements. And we put all of that together to come up with something which is the Responsibility 100, and so ranking of each of the FTSE 100 companies. And by the end of the year, we'll roll that out, the FTSE 250 companies. But just to pick up on a point that Claire made, some of the metrics we found are really effective. So some of them, you know, not least because I think for the work that people like Generation do, you've got quite good data now around emissions, right? Some of the data around S&G, to Claire's point, is really quite patchy. So we've had to deal with the fact that some companies don't report in some areas, and we want to try and encourage them to do so. But some of the reporting is there, it's just shocking. So if you take things like ethnicity pay gap reporting, or the reporting of the management split between Black, Asian, and ethnic minority colleagues and white colleagues, you know, only 2 out of the FTSE 100, I think rising to 3 now, the FTSE 100 companies do ethnicity pay gap reporting. Only 8 report their senior management. Now, the beauty of doing something like a Responsibility 100 Index is that it really forces you to look beyond the daily headlines and understand what companies are actually doing. And as a result of that, you mentioned the Responsible Business Forum. What we've invited companies to do, FTSE ones, but also private companies, other companies that are not listed or not necessarily on the FTSE, to join the Responsible Business Forum, which is our effort to try and drill into the data and drill into the metrics, because some of the issues that companies are facing, and I think it's companies that are really trying to do better, is that the metrics themselves are, as I say, they're either patchy or uneven or not particularly effective. And so the Responsible Business Forum is a meeting place where people get together and say, what do we think of our sustainability data? What do we think of our governance data? What do we think of our social impact data? And helping us to keep developing it. And just to say one final thing about the spirit of it, most journalism, as you know better than most, Craig, is done on a sort of ta-da moment. We sort of spring out of the blocks and tell you something you didn't know. The way we tried to do this was launch it in beta to reach out to all the FTSE 100 companies and give ourselves 3 months to develop the index so we understood what companies were saying and what they were doing, and then come and publish. And it was really quite iterative, it was quite responsive to what we heard, and it was better as a result. I don't claim that it's perfect. There is a fundamental, what I call good miner problem in this area, which is what happens if you happen to be in a sector that's dirty, if you like, and you're trying to do better. Are you a better company that's in a sector that is, if you like, clean, where you don't do very much to help the planet? These are metrics and these are trade-offs we're trying to understand. But that's what the Responsibility 100 Index is, and that's what the Responsible Business Forum is trying to do.
That sounds fascinating, and I've got a load of questions that we'll be putting to you in the second half of the call about it, because I'm sure the businesses will be really fascinated. Martha, I just want to come to you. You've got years of experience in this too, and you're working with a lot of Teneo's businesses on this, but you've all got partners on this, and you've also been spending a long time in previous lives on this. Just working across the Atlantic, are there differences there? Are there trends you're seeing that are different there? Or is Europe leading or America leading? What are you seeing from that side of the Atlantic?
Yeah, there's certainly differences in different areas. It's definitely, ESG is a global discussion and there are global investors, global voters, but there are definitely regional differences. What I wanted to do is cover off on some of those players in the broader ecosystem, investors, the companies that we advise, the business of being in the ESG business, like the raters and the rankers and the index players in it, and also talk a little bit about some of the shareholder pressures that we're seeing in the US right now, as well as some of the other stakeholder pressures. So first off, I wanted to note that it's an interesting context for today's discussion because we are at the 50th anniversary of Milton Friedman publishing his seminal article in the New York Times that says, business is in the business of doing business, making a profit, maximizing shareholder returns. And that really launched us into a half a decade of what's known as the shareholder primacy. And we're also a year out from the Business Roundtable in the US, having published its work on the purpose of a corporation and restating that the purpose is long-term. As David mentioned at the outset, long-term is best practice, a recognition that we've moved from shareholder primacy to stakeholder capitalism. So it's really an interesting time to take a look at this. And by the way, for that BRT article, over 180 CEOs of large US companies signed off on that. So there's a lot of commitment there, and it'll be interesting to see how commitment goes to action and measurable metrics and goals, which is always really the point in ESG. So I wanted to start by taking some of the players in this whole space with investors, and just a few fun facts to get us started. The record asset flow to ESG funds this year has passed $1 trillion total in assets under management, according to Morningstar. And 2020 is also on pace for a record number of ESG fund launches. So the money is there, and when the money's there, the money gets a lot of attention. I think probably everybody is very familiar with some of the letters from the big funds, the BlackRocks and State Streets of the world. Who hasn't read one of Larry Fink's letters that he publishes annually? And then in the US context, we do measure a lot of progress by shareholder proposals. We probably see more shareholder proposals than any market in the world. And the average level of ENS proposals, environmental and social proposals, back in 2000 was 6%. So not a lot of take up at all from shareholders on environmental and social issues. It's now up to approximately 25%. And while that might not sound like a lot, we're also seeing a record number of proposals that pass that are majority supported. We saw 18 this past proxy season, and that is a record. And as Claire mentioned, the E, the S, and the G all have come along at different times. My background is I spent 13 years leading research and policy at ISS, the proxy advisor. So we really watched that wave of growth in the overall G governance, all of the governance issues, whether it was say on pay, majority voting, the oversight that boards provide, independence, and so on. And then the E kind of came along, and as Claire mentioned, became more crystallized. And the last 6 months has really shown us the S and how a global pandemic or the protests we've seen in the US or the worker health and safety, all the issues under human capital management have really played out and have affected value fundamentally just over the last 6 months. The ESG ratings firms are a very big business. So another fun fact, probably most folks know about MSCI, which is one of the biggest raters. And just a heads up that MSCI actually owned ISS for a period of time around 2010. When I was at ISS, MSCI bought us and then eventually spun us out. But over 10 years ago in 2007, MSCI IPO'd at $25 a share. And go take a look at them today. They're selling around probably 350-ish a share, projected to go as high as 500, largely because of their index work and more specifically because of the ESG indices that they have. So there's a lot of players in this space. There's MSCI, Sustainalytics, S&P is in this game, ISS, the proxy advisor, they have a rating system. And even some of the bigger bigger institutional investors like State Street have now done their own proprietary rating. So companies are very tuned in on the ratings, and these are global ratings. We do a lot of work with companies, helping them take a look at the what we call a rating scorecard or how they're measuring up against these ratings. And what they might not be aware of is that it can affect access to capital. Because if you take a passive strategy like some of BlackRock's approaches, and they run off of a, let's call it an MSCI ESG index, they're not doing the portfolio construction. So BlackRock might be voting those shares, but they're not building out the portfolio. It's the index that's creating the portfolio. And if a company has a poor rating on that particular rating, such as MSCI, then they could either be eliminated if they have controversies, or they could be downweighted in the portfolio. And we often get the question from companies, well, how much funding am I losing? How much access to capital am I losing? There's no way to tell. All these indexes have proprietary methodologies. We can sort of guess at where the controversies are, but it's really very difficult to tell, impossible to tell how much funding one is actually losing. And a company could be a mediocre player in the ratings game and still be losing funding because they might be downweighted in portfolios. So companies are very tuned into the ratings, also to the disclosure. Data and disclosure are huge. I think that James earlier alluded to the need for data and for public data. And this is one of the big pressures on companies is to publish data. And the publication of data has really grown. So in 2011, the S&P 500, there were about 20% of them that published sustainability reports. It's over 90% right now. So that's very big. Shareholder pressures on diversity data in this country are huge. There's been a letter writing campaign by one of the asset owners, New York City, to over 70 companies asking for the publication of diversity data. And then I haven't mentioned exec comp, but I'm happy to take questions on it because we're seeing more of a push there for diversity and inclusion and other ESG metrics in exec comp. So let me, in the interest of time, I want to finish up with election. No secret, we have an election year, and the government is really going to play a big role. Trump has rolled back some of the initiatives from the Obama years. Biden has already come out and said day one they're going to rejoin Paris Agreement. So there's a lot going on and a lot riding on the election, And either way, you know, this whole space of ESG is going to continue to increase. So, Craig, I'll stop there and turn it back to you.
That was fascinating. Huge amount of detail there. So we're going to go to the Q&A part of this now. And the very first question that came through, I think, crystallizes a lot of this. It's an anonymous one, but it says, are you arguing that strong ESG performance directly results in financial success, or is it correlation rather than causation, i.e. management teams that have their act together will succeed at both? So I'm going to ask you all just in a sort of sentence or two, because we've got loads to get to go through that. David, let's start with you on that.
Yes, is the answer. We believe that a organization that understands the drivers of change, understands the impacts of sustainability, and use sustainable or use environmental or practice best practice environmental social governance factors, if you will be better businesses. Will be better businesses. Let me also fundamentally, and I should have said it in the beginning, we have always believed that this framework is not trading values for values. And that's really what this question is getting at to a certain degree. Is this correlation? Are you trading values for values? No, this is actually an understanding of what drives the long-term success of business.
Claire, do you buy that, or is it really about doing the right
thing? I think it's a bit of both, so there is clearly a momentum trade going on, and you know, BlackRock have published some very interesting data about performance during COVID of firms that score highly on ESG metrics, and also in previous turbulent times in markets. There is clearly momentum, partly because there is a pretty thinly traded universe of companies who are, you know, definitively on the side of angels. So, for example, if you take very, very few pure play renewable energy companies in the world, a handful, really. So you see definite momentum, you know, driving into publicly traded stocks. But equally, to David's point, there is emerging evidence. Just as, would you remember the groundbreaking HBS study about how diversity in boardrooms was positively correlated with better business results? That analysis is now being applied to a series of ESG factors, and it does appear to be the case that this actually does generate fundamentally better returns. But as Martha and David both said, we have an enormous amount of greenwashing, almost an industry rising of companies who are, you know, prepared to cut it different ways. And to James's point, you know, and I really commend what James is doing, sometimes it's just really hard to get good data. And I noticed a couple of the questions coming in on the feed saying, is there a global rating system? Is it likely to fragment? My view is there isn't. We have certain attempts. There's good work going on at the disclosure level. So for people that aren't familiar with the Task Force on Financial Disclosure, TCFD, this is a series of suggestions for companies to disclose actually what they're doing, the process rather than the results, but a hugely important first step. And New Zealand just mandated those. And I'd really like the UK to do so, because actually, if you can have some foundations and regulation in the spaces, it is an area where you can drive some commonality, which of course helps make these investment decisions easier.
James, on your responsibility index, can you see that businesses that take ESG seriously are actually prospering? You're on mute again, James. We still can't hear you. I'm not sure what's going on, James. I think we can't hear you. Let's just go to Martha quickly, and then we'll come back to you. Martha, do you think there is a direct correlation in terms of money?
Yeah, I think that I think my answer is going to be similar to David's, which is that when we work with companies and they have a very long-term perspective on business, their outlook is broader than just next quarter's earnings, then they are well-managed companies. And so, you know, in our market, and I think this is true globally, we're starting to move away focusing in on a next quarter and next quarter and next quarter, and really looking at sustainability in the big S, not sacrificing long-term for today's profits. And when companies do that, they're certainly better run, better managed, and ultimately really do produce better value.
James, let's try you again. No, I think that we've lost it. I think you log out and log back in, come back, and then we'll come back to you. And I'm going to move on to another question while you do that. Basically, we heard Martha talking about the US election. You talked about how well the EU is doing, Claire. A lot of people fear that this is, we're all a bunch of right-thinking metropolitan liberals who all take this seriously. And in a world where, to be frank, there are culture wars and populism does have a real role to play. Do you worry about that side of things, that people think that this isn't really something that is for them and is actually the establishment pushing through? Claire, let's start with you on that one.
Yeah, there was a great question on that, actually, on the chat about, you know, we're all CSR and sustainability officers are often seen as the kind of hippies in the corner, you know, with their drumming circles. And actually, there is something quite fundamental, I think, in the way that businesses treat this. All too often, you will have a CSR or a sustainability person or a board role that is siloed. And in effect, this, if you're serious about this, and the best companies are, this needs to run through your entire ops, including your procurement and your consumer facing activities. And I think we are seeing that in some of the most ambitious companies. But it is very striking, James, Craig, if you look at data on where people worry most about climate issues in particular, it is in the developing world. Why? Because they're facing floods, the droughts, the desertification. And there is this frustration, if you like, with the government-to-government conversation, because often there's this sense, you know, think of the rows in the UK about overseas development spending. There is this constant row about how much are you going to pay for us to help us deal with these issues. But I was having a call with one of India's largest conglomerates yesterday, who's one of our members. And, you know, without strong government regulation, they are absolutely seized with the fact to change the way that their businesses are operating, partly because they see the risk if they don't. And also partly because they see these global opportunities, the massive drive to electrification of transport and energy, the willingness on the part of the world to invest in new solutions for, you know, high heat industrial processes. So these companies are embracing this new future because they do see a global opportunity. You know, China wants to be the place where people buy electric cars, both for its own consumers and internationally. And I think it's a strong point, again, about this the impact of COVID. Oddly, the disruption it's causing is giving the corporate sector permission to kind of think the unthinkable, on the basis that who knows what our earnings are going to look like. A lot of it is very dependent on what government does in terms of shutting down demand over the next 6 months. So let's get on and tackle these tough problems that we know we need to face. And I'll finish with one other fact I always find fascinating. So I'm sure David and Martha know this, but the people behind The Big Short, the original firm that took The Big Short on banks exposed to the world's systems, are now shorting mortgage lenders in the United States because the mortgage lending process in the States is based on very outdated flood maps. And they can see very clearly the impact of that on the financial results of that sector. So this is starting to play out not just in the developing world, but also in the developed economies.
James, I hope you're back. We were asking you about whether you... We can hear you. We can hear you. That's good. Okay. We were asking about if you're noticing that people, the businesses that you're monitoring really are seeing improvements because of ESG. And then a second question is about this being seen as a kind of cultural battle where everybody who's promoting it comes from the establishment and is pretty liberal, and others see it as a bit of a conspiracy, really. But anyway, over to you.
So I think the first big point on David Blood's point about the correlation and the causation is, journalistically, we don't know yet. When we look at it, we can't really tell or see it. And the reason it's difficult is that, you know, if you look at a firm like Generation, there's not just the judgment call on the values of the companies, but there's real skill in judging the teams that run those companies and the choices they're making. We can't see it fully. And there is, I think, to Claire's point, a really deep suspicion of ESG, of purpose, of responsibility in the broader public. Claire mentioned BlackRock. You know, when we looked at the BlackRock ESG portfolio itself, one of the things that was just so extraordinary to us was the extremely low level of female participation at a board level of companies within the ESG portfolio. And so there is, I think, a really big public skepticism around what the Business Roundtable said versus what it does around, you know, you can do well by doing good, these mantras. And so part of what we're trying to do is actually identify what people say versus what they do. And I think over time, and I think it will only will be over time, Craig, that you begin to see how that feeds through. The one thing that feeds through very quickly is what you hear about recruitment. So when you look at companies that do very well, you're seeing on their ESG or on responsibility scores, you see that they do much, much better in terms of recruitment and particularly around diversity of recruitment, which is, as we all know, a really competitive thing right now.
David and Martha, there's a lot of questions coming through about, you know, people just trying to get a grip on this and a hold on this. And you both sort of alluded to November the 3rd when there's a presidential election, and it really does feel like that could go, you know, in two very, very different directions. How important is the new president of the United States or a second term for Trump in all of this? David, let's start with you.
Well, you know, we would say that clearly the U.S. is an important market. It would be unfortunate if the U.S. remained outside of the Paris Accord, et cetera. But I guess I'd like to say that this is a long-term macro discussion. What we do know, and whether Mr. Trump wins another term or not, we know that the climate is changing. That there, and business leaders around the world, including in the United States, recognize that the sustainability revolution will be the most important economic opportunity and transformation in history. We see innovators around the world who are responding to this. We now also know that the transition must be a just transition. The challenges of racial inequality, the challenges of poverty must be addressed. These are opportunities, and these are not necessarily political points of view. These are facts. We believe that businesses will be responding to these challenges. And indeed, we believe that civil society and government will require that businesses respond to these challenges. And so it could be in the short term, we have another 4 years of the Trump administration, but over the next 3, 4, 5, 10 years, you will fundamentally see gigantic opportunity and gigantic change. And that's happening no matter who wins the election on November 3rd.
Martha, it really is a huge deal if Biden or Trump are in the White House after come next January.
Yeah, I certainly concur with David. This is a long-term play, and what we're seeing is leaders outside of government right now coming together, whether it's working on a vaccine and a group of CEOs signs the letters that say the vaccine is not political. It's going to be there when it's there. It's not going to be there the end of October before Election Day. Those are the things that we're seeing. We saw over the summer with the racial injustice and the protests that went on in most of our major cities, we saw a lot of CEOs and their companies putting out statements on diversity and inclusion and a tremendous amount of philanthropy to a lot of these organizations, along with commitments and discussions. We've had discussions with some of our own clients about embedding some diversity and inclusion goals into their executive compensation. So I do agree that this is a long-term play, well beyond the next 4 years. That said, obviously, Biden is going to make things happen quicker, and Trump has already put a damper on some of the interpretations that the Obama administration has done. And I'll just give you a brief example of this that has sort of flown under the radar, but has a big effect on whether or not individuals can put money into ESG funds in their retirement accounts. And that is the Department of Labor, which governs in this country, governs the retirement plans. And we have 401ks here. Has changed an Obama interpretation on whether or not you can have an ESG fund in there. So I, in my 401k, can say, I want an ESG fund. I want that money to go to ESG-focused funds. And they're saying that it is the fiduciary's obligation to focus on return. And therefore, anything outside of pecuniary interests is not appropriate. And anybody that wants to allow ESG funds into that fund family and to allow it in those 401ks has to have a real high hurdle on proving out that it's not sacrificing returns to garner the environmental and social impacts. It's a proposal on the table. It's fallen a little bit under the radar, but what it essentially does is say that if you're an employee here and you're putting money into a fund family, you can't have one of those ESG funds as one of your options.
Thank you. James and Claire, we're getting a couple of questions. I'll bring you in on that in a moment, James. We're getting a couple of questions about, you know, just the sheer title ESG and whether or not it actually yes. To be redefined. The governance bit seems to me to be the problem child of this. Like, very little of our discussion has focused on it. It's there, it's a big letter at the end of it. James, is that an issue? Is it such a big deal? Is it something we actually maybe just need to redesign? We're really talking about purpose for a business here, and the governance side of it is by the by?
Look, I think it's a really big deal, right? Every organization is ultimately determined by the way it's run and who runs it. And it's one of those classic business things, isn't it, that we come up with a group of words that are agreed by many people but don't have much excitement or energy to them. So there is a problem in the branding of ESG. I think there is something, though, that's going to just pick up on your last point, Craig, and the point that Dave and Martha were making about the relationship between politics and ESG. And I totally take the point that David was making, which is this is happening anyway. Climate's happening anyway. Social justice is happening anyway. You know, responsibility at the top of companies is happening anyway. I'll just make a point that there's reverse traffic here that's worth noting, which is the politicization of money, and particularly things like the politicization of pensions. So one of the things that's very strange about this is that in the political climate, there is a great, great lack of trust. Right? People think that our politicians lie. Right? That's bled across, obviously, to corporate leadership and a lack of trust in corporate leadership. And now there are people who are purporting to be responsible to do good, but there's going to be much closer scrutiny. So I was struck by Martha saying she'd come out of the ISS and the proxy voters. You know, 10 years ago, no one knew who the proxy voters were. Suddenly, people are really taking an interest in those people. You know, no one knew who pension trustees were or pension advisors were. Suddenly, those groups of people are really going to come under scrutiny because their investment decisions feel intimately connected to really important issues about social justice and sustainability.
So Claire, if the G part is as important, don't we need to start talking about it a lot more and defining it a bit more?
Yeah, and Andrew Hobbs has just put up this thing about, you know, as in so many cases, if you get the G right, the other bits follow. And look, I am sort of fascinatingly, there is a sort of muscularity around the G now emerging, is my sense. Coming often from David and Martha's world, coming from activist shareholders, coming from the investment community, saying we demand that you do this in order to essentially earn your social permission to operate, but also coming from consumers. I saw something on the chat line about, this is very difficult because are people prepared to pay for it? I think the challenge is because it is so ill-defined. You know, we don't have a good carbon label, let alone an ESG label that people trust. It's very hard to use your green dollars or green pounds to effectively. And I just wanted to make a point that I think it must be super difficult for those in a governance role, which is this. I'd actually invert what James has said. I think we have a huge amount of excitement about ESG, but huge disagreement about what it is. And there is so much ideology in this space. So if you take, for example, let's use BP because it's now the most ambitious publicly traded fossil fuel company. They have basically said, we want to be net zero. We're going to do this we're going to reprice our oil portfolio. This is what we're going to do. And we're going to do a lot of carbon abstraction. Every net zero plan requires carbon to be put away somewhere, either chemically or biologically. If you talk to the hardcore activists, the fact that BP wants to invest massively in biological offsets with lots of co-benefits in terms of biodiversity, just rural transition, is just terrible. Like there is no way can those offsets be accepted. They are tainted at source because they come from a fossil fuel company. And I think one of the big challenges for those who want to lead this transition from within companies is resisting some of this ideology, this resisting this idea of saying, we define what good looks like in it, often quite an irrational way. And we have to almost ignore some of those, that clamor, some of that clamor that results every couple of weeks in protests in London, and just get on with it. Because while we argue, you know, if anyone else follows the Mauna Loa daily CO2 readings like I do, the world continues to get more and more emissions to deal with. And so there is, I think, a real need for people to stand up and say, this is what we're doing. It might not be perfect, but it is good. And we will iterate this process going forward, but we will just get on with the bits of this that where we actually can see a good pathway.
Okay, Martha and David, I want to put this question to you. It's from Gilles Morel, who's the EMEA CEO of Whirlpool, which is obviously one of the biggest white goods manufacturers in the world. He says, ESG is indeed a matter of trade-offs, or rather choices. It seems that people are not ready to pay for sustainability. This is a social challenge for governments or economic or for industries. How to ensure we make these choices more acceptable for people and do not slow down? So, David, let's come to you on that one.
Well, I do agree that one has to be holistic and understanding.
Make it a bit less bad.
David, keep going. I think we'll just have a little bit.
Oh, no worries. I do agree that that one, when one is assessing ESG, one has to recognize that there can be trade-offs. And what you may have an extraordinary business that is addressing the transition to net zero, and at the same time, a business that is doing terrible things to communities or to employees. And so you have to make those assessments. What I don't agree with about the question is that in all cases, the drive to net zero or the drive to a just transition costs. And in fact, I think just the opposite. As I said, the transition to net zero is about economic opportunity. It's about driving profitability. It's not only about trade-off. It's about driving long-term profitability. This will be the most significant economic opportunity in history. And if you're looking at it as what's going to happen in the short term, as opposed to what are the opportunities across multiple sectors, almost everything we've done today will have to change to get to net zero. This is not just about alternative energy. It's across the entire economic spectrum. So with that as a backdrop and understanding that direction, that's about driving economic opportunity, revenues, profitability, and competitive positioning.
So Martha, but the Gilles is somebody who's running a major business, and his experience is like literally selling millions of these machines, is that, you know, he's struggling to get people to pay for sustainability. That's a real thing for business, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what does it mean to really pay for sustainability? And I want to go back to a concept that I think all of us have touched on, which is the engine that's going to drive all of this is data and disclosure. And we saw that in the, you know, in the early 2000s with just the G part of ESG, which was all of the governance initiatives that happened, whether it was more data on executive compensation, more data on board composition and structure. All of that data really fueled the ability to do studies, to benchmark. We're doing a lot of benchmark and analysis right now with companies on ESG. So that data and disclosure is really important to understand what does it mean to pay for sustainability? What are the trade-offs? How do you measure and manage them? Claire mentioned one of the frameworks, and I want to mention a second one. Claire mentioned TCFD, which is really focused on climate and climate disclosures. The other one is SASB, so SASB, like FASB, but with an S. And SASB is across the boards ESG, not just in climate, but with the S, all of the aspects of it by industry, by sector. And it's grounded in a materiality framework. The materiality definition is based on the SEC's definition of materiality, but it's meant to be a global framework. And some of the big institutional investors like BlackRock, like State Street and others have called on companies to be compliant with these frameworks, or they're actually going to take it to the ballot box. And they've said that they're going to start voting against directors at companies that don't comply with these frameworks by next year. And so one of the discussions we're having with companies now is, under these frameworks, how do you measure and manage and put metrics next to the cost and the opportunities for all of this? So whether or not you're doing an acquisition, let's say, and you're acquiring a company that might have stranded assets, or you simply have a data center that's located on a floodplain, or you have worker health and safety issues, all of those things, while they might not necessarily be, have been considered non-financial, have been considered financial impacts, they're non-financial impacts, but they're still measurable and they're still meaningful.
And just picking up on that point, James, I was interested in you saying that one of the things that you found hardest was on the social side of things, getting, you know, meaningful data. In terms of diversity, that's pretty obvious and straightforward, but a lot of the other stuff is a bit more amorphous and a bit difficult to get your arms around. Can you talk a bit more about how you'd like to see that measured and what kind of thing beyond diversity?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. On sustainability and emissions, you've got really good granular data. As Martha was saying, around remuneration, around pay, there's obviously just a lot of work on this. On social, what we're really struggling with is not just around diversity, but also social impacts, investment in education, community impacts. And a lot of companies do a lot of work in this area, but the data is not comparative. So what we've tried to do is create this responsible business forum so that people can come together and try and identify ways of coming up with comparative data. I see a lot of people are talking about, are there standardized global tests? A lot of people are trying to work on this, and actually it only pays to be collaborative. The World Economic Forum did some work, the Business Roundtable has done some work. We try to work with those data sets rather than against them, and use them to inform our data. And so the most valuable thing is having public data. What we try to do is, when no data is available, is give a company a median score. And I know this seems like a very small nerdy point, but by giving a company a median score where they don't provide the data, it makes it, we don't punish them unnecessarily, but it makes it impossible for them to be best in class. So we're trying to create incentives in the structure of the index that incentivize everyone to produce more data.
Okay, that's very helpful. We're coming right up against the end of time here. I just want to ask one question to the whole panel, and please just stick to a couple of sentences for time reasons. How optimistic are you that this is going to charge forward and grow and be a major success going forward? So Martha, let's start with you.
It's an imperative. It's a must have. We must solve climate change. It's an imperative for all of us. And we certainly have to solve the social issues, especially in the U.S. So it's absolutely, the rate of increase is going to continue to increase.
Claire, you're a politician and dealt with politicians. Are you feeling optimistic about their ability to do it? You're on mute, Claire. We need to take you off mute.
Putting aside optimism or otherwise about politics, to Martha's point, I think this is an imperative, and that ultimately we're going to have to act now or later if we want to have, you know, set operating boundaries for the way that we understand the world that we can live with. And so either we act now in a controlled way where we maximise the opportunity and minimise the cost, or we have a major crisis moment where we're busy looking at those geoengineering solutions like refreezing the poles, which are wildly out of the money and quite disruptive. So I think it is an imperative. I actually think that I'm more positive sitting oddly outside government, because I saw up close how difficult it was, to go back to where I started, for policymakers to come together in a kind of global forum. But I'm incredibly encouraged by this extraordinary ambition that is being driven a lot by the shareholder pressures and the disclosure pressures we've talked about in the private sector. Of course, there are great pockets of emitters, like all the state-owned enterprises who are pumping out, you know, fossil fuels from their activities in the developing world, who are very hard to get to. But ultimately, the costs of inactivity rise, the risk of stranded assets gets ever higher, and the missed opportunities from being a first mover in this space start to diminish. So there is a real head of steam, and I am more optimistic that we can really forge progress. And by the way, if I may, you know, in, just to put this in context, in order to hit a 1.5-degree scenario by 2050, we'd need to have a COVID-type hit to the world's greenhouse gas emissions every single year for the next 20 years. And that, I think, puts the size of the challenge in context.
David, in a sentence, I know you think it's an imperative. Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic, and the reason why I'm optimistic is that ESG and sustainability is the driver of great business, great long-term businesses, and the best CEOs in the world know this already.
James, I think your Twitter handle is Harding the Hack. As a hack, you should be pretty skeptical. Are you optimistic?
You're totally right, Craig. It's a bad look for a journalist, but I'm very optimistic, and I'll give you a single reason. We started the Responsibility 100 Index last year, and within 6 months, 83 of the FTSE 100 companies had directly and meaningfully got in touch with us to talk through their role and their data. And if 83 companies, and we're talking at CEO, chairman level, board level, all engaged in the subject, it suggests to me that this is not a subject that's down the hallway and, you know, like in the CSR department. It's at the very top of those companies. So, yes, I have reason to be optimistic.
Brilliant. We've had a fantastic panel. They're amazing. One of the things that I always say about this is you can't give a round of applause, but I know you'll be getting a virtual standing ovation from all our clients who've joined. It's been fascinating. Martha, David, Claire and James, thank you very much. I certainly feel like I know a lot more about it than I did at the start. Thank you.